beautiful afternoon. It's far more fun to be outdoors. Thank you for the sight of the scenery here. But I appreciate all of your being here. Today we're going to get to the part of the economy talk where we look at the whole question of social justice. And I know that's for some people lately kind of a bad word. And in fact, some of you may have noticed that Glenn Beck has suggested that if your church uses the word justice, if you hear the word justice used in your church, you should run from that church as fast and as far as possible. Anybody hear that?
Yeah.
So, I've heard the word justice used here sometime more than once. In any case, I have heard it used. So we are going to talk today a little bit about this thing called the greatest number. For you who haven't been, and I recognize most of the faces, but for you who haven't been here before, we've been looking at the economy through the lens of Gifford Pinchot, the first director of the United States Forest Service, idea that the real purpose of the economy ought to be the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. And we've defined the greatest good as quality of life, and we've looked at some of these things like measurements of that, like health and security and happiness and family and connection and those kind of things. And now we're going to get into this subject of the greatest number, which is essentially, you know, how fair is our society. And I'm going to show you the clip. We just had one act on that in the film, What's the Economy For? Anyway, but before we show that clip, I want to introduce the star of the show, Dave Babker. I told him that this is proof to you that television cameras can be flattering. actually, they're usually just the opposite. But Dave will be here through Saturday as well, and he will be more than delighted to talk to any of you about some of the things, particularly regarding the economy. Even though I only play an economist on TV, as you have seen so far, Dave, in fact, is a real economist. And he is a practicing economist, and he is the director of Earth Economics, which is an ecological economics nonprofit in Tacoma, Washington, that works on a lot of things like environmental restoration and what we call ecosystem services, and some of the things that you will see if you're here tomorrow. Tomorrow's talk is about the longest run, and that's really about the environment and about sustainability, and Dave will be doing that, and I will be sitting in a chair watching, so you'll be able to talk with Dave about that. Dave will also be happy and may chime in today with any answers to questions that you can have. Before we start, I'd like to just ask you, generally, what do you know or what have you heard recently about inequality in America, whether it's increased or decreased, how we stand among the world's wealthy countries when it comes to inequality? What sort of information is out there? What have you heard? Anybody want to volunteer? Yes?
Well, the number and the amount in the wealthy end is very much increasing, and the number and the amount in the low end is very much increasing.
And the middle is kind of shrinking.
We're losing the bell curve.
Yes. All right, up there.
Yeah, that the inequality of those who have to those who have not is proportionate to the adherence to the law. Those who, wealthier countries are those who in fact have a tendency to adhere to law as opposed to those who don't.
Okay, I'm not sure I totally follow that, but if you want to explain that anymore?
Well, I don't know. It was actually an earlier macroeconomic lecture that I heard here before, but it's the adherence to the law of knowing that the system can bring forward, again, justice. But, you know.
Okay. Yes.
When you compare us with other countries, we don't know so good.
Okay, that's one thing, and I think you will find that, in fact, the gap between Richard Moore and the United States is very, very wide in comparison, that's right, with other countries. Yes?
I'm going to go to taxes. I think someplace I read where the number of people paying the cost of operating their government, relatively speaking, is very small to the number of people who do not contribute to the cost of government. And my question is, that goes beyond that, is what about countries like Denmark and the other four countries as far as the percentage of people that contribute to the cost of their government?
Ah, good. Okay. We're actually going to talk about that a little bit later. We're going to talk a little bit about...
You look good on there.
We're going to talk a little bit about the whole issue of how other countries do taxes and who pays and who shares in that. But let's try to get this working again. It just shut off right at the right time, of course. So we'll hopefully get started. All right. Play.
Social justice, isn't it? So how do we know if a society is fair, if our society is fair? Well, for starters, we can check out the gap between rich and poor. The United States has the widest gap between rich and poor of any wealthy country. And it's getting wider all the time. Right now, the top 1% of Americans earn more each year than the bottom 50% all put together.
Exactly.
The average CEO makes 400 times what the average worker does. Inequality of that magnitude creates another problem. Remember consumer sovereignty? The idea that the invisible hand of the market gives us what we as consumers really want? Each of us a king, voting with our dollars? Democracy in action? Well, wait a minute. My civic textbooks told me democracy meant one person, one vote. But in the market as it is right now, those CEOs have 400 votes for every one vote their workers have. The poor might need apartments or good schools or health care, but they don't have enough votes. So we get a run on luxury yachts, private jets, and $5,000 handbags. Now hold on, you say. So what? Nobody guaranteed anybody equality of results. What we offer in America is equality of opportunity. It's up to everyone to grab the golden ring. Even our economic mobility is running out of gas. If you're born poor in America, you're less likely to end up comfortable than in any wealthy country except the United Kingdom. Only one-third as likely as a Dane, for example. Half as likely as those Canadians up there. As a matter of fact, as an American, you're twice as likely to live in poverty as a European would be. You could say it's the invisible hand of the unregulated market picking your pocket.
Yeah, you do it. All right. We gotta, all right. You know how to do it. Yeah, do it flat. There we go. So what we have seen, I think, is that, and this is agreed across the board, we have seen quite an increase in inequality over the last 30 years, to the degree that the gap now between rich and poor in America is about the same as it was right before the Great Depression in the late 1920s. And that was the widest it had been. And then for a number of years, it got much, much narrower. From really the early 1930s until about the mid-1970s, and then that changed again. And we saw the same, the same situation occurring with mobility, that is, people's opportunity to change their economic circumstances and to rise from the bottom quarter of the population, who being born in the bottom quarter of income earners, to rise up to the top quarter. And this is usually the way we determine or measure economic mobility. Now, the issue here is that some people say that inequality really doesn't matter. They say it doesn't really make a big difference in terms of how happy people are. They say it doesn't matter for a lot of reasons. And this argument is made very forcefully in a new book, which I recommend that people read. This book is exactly the opposite point of view than you are hearing from me. So I can tell you, this book is called The Battle. It is quite high on Amazon's list right now. I think the last time I checked, it was number 48 on the Amazon list, which is very high. I would love it if my book ever got there. But in any case, this book was written by Arthur Brooks, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank. And the book is endorsed by none other than Karl Rove as a must-read for conservatives who want our movement to dominate the intellectual and policy debates of America's coming vital decades. Also by Newt Gingrich and by Dick Cheney, this is the playbook for the resurgence of the free enterprise movement. So this book is quite a handbook right now. And one of the points that Mr. Brooks makes in the book, and he's a very smart man, a scholar, was a professor at Syracuse University. He says that really money doesn't buy happiness. He agrees with that. We've talked about that, and he uses some of the happiness data. And he says what does make you happy is what he calls earned success. And he explains earned success as this. He says, earned success means the ability to create value honestly, not by winning the lottery, not by inheriting a fortune, not by picking up a welfare check. It doesn't even mean making money itself. Earned success is the creation of value in our lives or in the lives of others. It isn't just related to commerce. Earned success is also what parents experience when their children do wonderful things, what social innovators feel when they change lives, and what artists feel when they create something of beauty. I don't think any of us would disagree with this. I mean, I think this is true. And that kind of success, that sense that we make a difference in the lives of others, absolutely is vital to happiness. It's not the only thing. We've explored some of the other things that are also important for happiness, but it is vital, and it is important to happiness. But then Mr. Brooks takes all of this one step further. And he says, if money without earned success does not bring happiness, then redistributing money won't make for a happier America. And he says, knowing as we do that earning success is the key to happiness rather than simply getting more money, the goal of our political system should be this: to give all Americans the greatest opportunities possible to succeed based on their hard work and merit. And that's exactly what the free enterprise system does. It makes earned success possible for most people. This is the liberty our founders wrote about, that liberty that enables the true pursuit of happiness. So this is the central theory of this book, that we don't want to do any of these kind of things, that even though wealth and income have gotten very, very wide, we don't want to do anything to reduce that, because in fact, that won't do anything to make people happy, it will take away from apparently the earned success of those who have it. What do you think about that argument? Would anybody say But do y'all agree with that, or would anyone say that there might be some issues with that?
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Is that organization associated out of Springfield, Missouri?
No, the American Enterprise Institute? No, it's in Washington, D.C. It's a big, big conservative thing.
Okay,
tank.
Because there's a company, there's an organization out of Springfield, Missouri. I can't think of the exact title. One of the leaders of it is a former president of Walmart.
Oh, okay.
Jack Schumacher.
Who says the same kind of thing.
I don't know that much about it, but they had a name an awful lot like that.
Well, yeah. Well, it is, I mean, this is pretty common. I mean, this sort of thing point is made in a number of places. But what might be a logical inconsistency or problem with that argument? Yes?
There's a phrase in what you read where it says the point that we want to follow or the thing we want to follow is to provide everyone with an opportunity to. And it seems to me that what he would have to answer is if the gap between the poorest and the most wealthy is widening, are we not severely limiting more and more the opportunity for the poorer people to have an opportunity to?
And when we see that social mobility in the country, which used to be one of the best countries in the world in terms of the opportunity, has in fact gotten less and less. This is really an interesting thing because the contradiction here, I think, is that what we find is that inequality itself decreases opportunity. And it decreases opportunity to have what Amartya Sen, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, has written about, in which he says that what people need to go about their lives are capacities. They need skills. They need competencies. They need these kinds of things. And what we see then, in fact, Warren Buffett is a good example. Warren Buffett said, do you think, he said, if I was born in Bangladesh, I would have the kind of income and life that I have? No. I didn't earn it all on my own, although obviously Warren Buffett works hard. But Warren Buffett says, no. Part of this was I was lucky. I was born into a situation where I got given to me a very good education, a family who could then further that by giving me a good college education. And Warren Buffett says it's really, really unfair right now that, in fact, Warren Buffett, pays less a percentage of his income in taxes than his secretary. Warren Buffett says this. You know, this is not some far-out person. This is one of America's richest and most respected fellows. Bill Gates Sr., who's a wonderful guy, the father of the great Microsoft founder, Bill Gates Sr. says precisely the same things, that we have some kind of responsibility, that we are not simply these, quote, self-made men. What we have done is stood on other shoulders. We have benefited from things that people do as a society. And so it matters whether there is some fairness in the schools we go to. And if you know anything about our school system in the United States, you know that there are enormous differences between the quality of schools that some students go to and have the opportunity to go to and those that others do. Some have all the finest equipment, the highest quality teachers, others, you know, everything is not only second rate, but the books, the desks. If you see one of some of these schools, you know what I mean. This starts also even in preschool, where you know, so many kids, and we know that that's very important. We've talked about how important that is for children. So just in this sense alone, in this possibility for opportunity, inequality matters. But inequality matters in a whole lot of other ways. There's a recent book that came out, it's called The Spirit Level, Kind of a funny term. It makes sense in England. The spirit level is just a level. It's a carpenter's level, which we have, and it's, you know, kind of, it's when it's level, you know, but I don't know why they chose this time. Believe me, they don't know why they chose it. In fact, I have met the authors, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who are from Great Britain, and they say that this title was picked by their publisher, and they have no idea why the publisher picked the title. But nonetheless, the spirit level is full of all kinds of fascinating information about how equality or inequality affects societies. And the subtitle of the book is Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. And they look at a whole lot of things. So whether it's health, or whether it's overall social problems, or whether it's things like trust, that more equal societies are, that is, the smaller the gap between rich and poor, the more trust you actually see in these societies. So again, the Scandinavian countries, which we've talked about quite a bit, the score for trust, that is, they always do these polls of how much how people feel between 1 and 100. Scores for trust in Norway, Sweden, Denmark are roughly 66-67%. That's it. The question is asked, you know, how much do you trust the people around you, your neighbors, friends, and so forth. The average score in the United States for trust is 36. So that's a big gap. Now, this is a very interesting thing. They know that these levels of trust are actually very closely correlated with reality. Because what they do is they go and they leave wallets filled with $100 or $200. They leave them in places just out in public, on a street, in different countries, and they see what will happen. And so they ask people in Sweden, what do you think the chances are that your wallet will be returned with all the money inside? And the Swedes say, about 2/3 of the Swedes say they think their wallet will be returned with the money inside. About 1/3 of Americans say they think that their wallet will be returned with the money inside. And in fact, the results are almost exactly what they predict. About 2/3 of the wallets are returned in those countries. About 1/3 of the wallets are returned with the money intact in the United States. More of the wallets are returned, but the money is often not there. The wallet itself at least is returned anonymously. So that does happen. Now, but if you can look at many other things, mental illness, these things are much higher depending on the level of inequality in the country. I can pass around some things. These are, you can go to equalitytrust.uk. This is the website of this book, The Spirit Level, and you can see all the data in all kinds of social issues and things. Well, I'll just pass these around, you can look at them, and they show how inequality plays out in a number of these kinds of categories. So everything from test scores, educational scores internationally, and the same thing plays out in the States. The same thing plays out in the states of the United States. So the greater the inequality in states, the higher the level of the social problems, the lower, the poorer the health, the poorer the mental health, and so forth. And so how many of you here are from Minnesota? Nobody? Oh, one. Okay. Holden, nobody's here from Minnesota? Oh, yeah. I don't think I've ever been in Holden when nobody put my hands up went up first from Minnesota, you know, so usually half the room. But anyway, those of you from Minnesota, your state does very, very well. It's very, very high in these kind of things. And again, the states that have greater equality do that. And you can, let me just give you a little bit of a bit here.
here. Okay, this is from Robert Putnam, who of Harvard, who wrote a famous book called Bowling Alone, which is about social connection in America. Some of you may have seen that book. And what he says is that social capital, and social capital is this thing, these connections between people that are represented by how strong our communities and our ties are. Social capital and economic equality moved in tandem through most of the 20th century. In terms of the distribution of wealth and income, America in the 1950s and 1960s was more egalitarian than it had been in more than a century. And those same decades were also the high point of social connectedness and civic engagement in the United States. Record highs in equality and social capital coincided. Conversely, the last third of the 20th century was a time of growing inequality and eroding social capital. And he goes on to explain this further. One of the things we also see is that this starts very early with children, and this is whole question of opportunity. So we see that, for instance, in the least equal states, a child in the bottom 10 states is twice as likely to die by the age of 14 as our children in the top 10 states. And if you look at the top 10 states for these kind of things, they are Wisconsin, Iowa, New Jersey, Washington, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, number one ranked New Hampshire. If you look at the states on the bottom in this particular case for inequality for children, those states happen to be Wyoming, Georgia, Arkansas, Alabama, South Carolina, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Louisiana, and in last place, Mississippi. So children in the bottom 10 states are seven times more likely to die from abuse and neglect as children in the top 10 states. Goes on. Juveniles in the bottom 10 states are almost 2.5 times as likely to be incarcerated as juveniles in the top 10. Children in the bottom 10 states are 74% more likely to die before their first birthday as our children in the top 10 states. So we can see this, and there's a whole lot more of this kind of data. But inequality really does matter, and it does make a difference, and it's not just that changing it is not just about earning success, but it's in fact how we make it possible so that people can earn success. Before we go a little bit into how you might achieve more equality, does anybody have questions, comments, reactions, and such? Yes?
We've talked about the United States, but how does the cost of education or education monies put forward by the top five countries compare with what we put forth in this country?
Mm-hmm. They're not too different. Denmark and Sweden spend a little bit more per capita on education than we do. The best country in the world, who knows what country consistently ranks number one in the world when it comes to test scores on math, science, and reading?
Japan.
No, but Japan is close.
Finland.
But who said it?
Up here.
You said Finland. That's the correct answer. Finland ranks number one in the world in those kind of stats. What do we know about Finland and its education system? Very interesting. Anybody know what's somewhat different about Finland's education system? What do they do differently than we do? Their scores are much, much higher than ours.
They start later.
They start a little later, actually. Although they do have preschool kind of stuff, but their formal schooling starts at 7. Other things they do.
They have 45 minutes of teaching for every hour and 15 minutes of play.
Yeah, they do, right. They actually have a lot. They actually have some of the shortest hours, believe it or not, of schooling. And the score, and among the shortest school years, is not having more and more time that makes a difference. They are also number one in the world in the amount of time in the classroom they spend on art and music. Art and
music, believe it or not, actually affects academic performance in the other areas like math and sciences in a positive way. The Finns have shown this. But what they really do is they're very, very, again, egalitarian. Their schools all receive the same kinds of supports and finances, and their teachers are not only very well paid, they are, even more importantly, very well respected. It is a profession in which society thinks that this is a valued thing. And so Finland does extremely well in this. And they don't really spend more than we do, but they definitely spend more fairly in a sense of every Finnish child getting basically the same kind of breaks. Of course, it's never going to be exactly the same, because that's going to depend on individual teachers and so forth. But the resources invested are relatively the same. Any other questions or comments? Yes?
I guess I have two questions. One would be whether race comes into the thing in the United States. The other is obviously the size of the population.
Mm-hmm.
How do other large countries stack up?
Right. It's a good question. And certainly race does play a role, because it's sometimes hard to separate that from income levels, and it plays a role in our income levels. There's no question about that. For years, before we passed the civil rights legislation of the mid-60s, there was this idea of separate but equal. Any of you remember that notion? And of course, the Civil Rights Act and the Supreme Court decisions around that were passed because people found that there really was no such thing as separate but equal. Mm-hmm.
How could Finland not spend more but still pay their teachers well?
That's a good question. It's a very good question.
Maybe they don't support football teams.
Well, there may be something to that. You know, I'm going to have to say I don't know the answer.
What are their building requirements?
What are the building requirements?
As far as the schools.
Earthquake
resistance. Are they required to put some of the things in their schools?
Oh, I'm sure that they're required. I don't know how earthquake prone Finland is, but I'm sure that their rules for safety and things like that are very, very strong.
Yeah. But have they gone overboard on some of the stuff like we have in this country? Or what we would say, many of us would say, overboard. You know, like California, for example, the first one to say every building had to be freestanding, so if an earthquake came along, it wouldn't fall down. That relates to Earl Warren.
Well, you know, and I don't know. So but it has been interesting to kind of see what Finland does and the importance of teaching and the fairness. Yes.
What is their school year? You said they start at age 7.
Mm-hmm.
How many grades do they go through? Is it like some of the countries where they go into the trade a academic high school with the trade options and these things? What type of a?
I don't think that's as strong as in a country like Germany, for example. But there is certainly some of that. And this is of course a whole complicated question about how valuable those kind of things are, whether they give, you know, whether they. They may seem to be less fair in some ways, but in other ways they do offer people training that turns into jobs for those people. But these are really good questions. And again, I'm not an expert on the educational systems of these other countries. But the difference is simply that we do see between the fairness and the results are pretty. They're pretty strong, that as far as I can tell. So how do these countries achieve some of their greater equality? And if we look at equality, Japan is probably the most egalitarian large country. Somebody had the question about large countries. Yeah, and of course there is no country anymore in the world other than China and India that are larger than the United States, and they don't compare in any way with us. Their level of development is simply very, very different, and I don't
I don't make a comparison between the United States and those countries. But if you look at the very large Western European countries, such as Great Britain, Germany, and France, and stuff, for the most part, they do a little better than we do in education. Italy is an exception. Italy's scores tend to be lower than the United States. There are a couple of other European countries certainly where that's true. The United States doesn't do really bad when it comes down to education. We're just a little bit below the middle when it comes to the industrial countries in terms of our test scores and our educational outcomes. And obviously, we have a terrific university and college system. It's the envy of the world, although it's declining in some ways, and it's getting harder and harder, and inequality plays a role in this for young people to be able to go to college and to afford it and not to come out of college with immense amounts of debt. That's harder. I went to the University of California, and probably you'll assume that this is where I got all my weird ideas in the first place. But I got out of high school in 1964 in California, and I went to the University of California at Berkeley. And you know what it cost me? Any guess?
$100 a year plus books or something like that. Not very much.
Not very much. $126 a semester. That was the total cost plus books. Now that $126, though, was not only my tuition and all of that at the University of California, it also included free health care. The University Health Service took pretty darn good care of us. I mean, it wasn't, like the top of the line, but you could certainly go in whenever you had a problem as a student at the University of California.
What is that in today's dollars?
What is that in today's dollars?
Yep.
Probably about $1,000 a semester. Maybe a little more.
That's beautiful.
But not a lot more. And if you look now, that's another issue, because at that time, let's estimate. It's probably going to be a little over $1,000 a semester, but we're in today's dollars. At that time, the minimum wage, in 1968, the minimum wage reached its highest level in terms of what it would actually provide for people. It's actually declined since then. It went way down until fairly recently when it went back up again somewhat. But if the minimum wage in the United States were today to be the same in buying power as it was in 1968, it would be about $9 an hour. And it's $7.25 now is the national minimum wage. Washington State has a higher minimum wage. We have the highest actually in the country, and it is graduated by, to meet cost of living. So those kind of things have affected things as well. And if we look at some of these other countries, the way they get to be more equal, some of it's done by taxes, but not all. Some of it is definitely happens before the fact. They have higher minimum wages. Minimum wage in Norway essentially is about $18 an hour. Minimum. Yeah.
Yeah, I was reflecting on the fact that your tuition in California may have been part of the $18 billion deficit in Ohio.
No.
In California.
To today's deficit?
Yeah, that's where it started. In other words, they weren't taxing to provide the benefits that you had.
The fun of games they played with Jarvis Gannett in recent years.
Now, here's a Californian who knows. I don't think that's the case. I don't remember exactly, but I don't remember California having budget busting kind of crises in that time.
They also had a part-time legislature in those years.
Ah, okay. This guy knows it's California.
Yeah, but don't you think that would start the largesse that they started providing education and everything else? How did they get into an $18 billion deficit thing?
They started monkeying with Jarvis Gann. And Jarvis Gann was 1% what you paid for a house, period, bang, in a discussion. Several years later, as people wanted to sell their houses, but they didn't want to buy a new house and lose are scammed and have to pay 1% of the new house's sale price. So they got through the legislature to modify that so he didn't lose your the 1% break you or deal you're getting. And you
with
pay,
the original price.
With the original, yeah, you paid your property taxes, so you still can take that break when you bought your new house instead of your property tax. You had 1% of the $200,000 you paid for that new house.
Instead of the
$25,000. Instead of
the
$25,000 you paid for the first house.
I'm sorry, that was sort of a
non-sequitur. No. These are good points, and it's great. I mean, this is what we need to have I certainly don't know the answers to all of these questions. And I'm not suggesting that you have to agree with me on everything. I think the idea here, though, is to get us to think about these things and ask some of these questions about what we can do. Yes?
I was wondering whether you have any kind of feeling on whether stronger centralized governments in Western Europe play a greater role in reducing inequality than 50 states with 50 policies in the U.S.?
His question is whether a more centralized system, you know, one government versus 50 different governments setting rates, has a lot to do with the differences. And it probably has something to do with them, no question. Also, funding of elections and things like that in those countries, which is not nearly, there's a lot of time, for instance, in television, which is Grand Prix, they don't allow the same kind of corporate spending and things in elections. The kind of essentially buying of candidates is much less likely to be allowed in these other countries. And now, of course, with our recent Supreme Court decision, we've made it almost total. I mean, you can basically they can spend as much as they want to support candidates and. So far, the Supreme Court has ruled that, so that will probably make it even tougher to get these things. But one of the things is that Europe does some different things in terms of how they tax. And we rely quite a lot in this country on the income tax. We rely a certain amount on corporate tax. It's often pointed out that European corporate tax rates are lower than American corporate tax rates, and that's true. That's actually true in most of those countries, but what's also true is that the money there is collected. Whereas about two-thirds of American corporations virtually manage to avoid paying taxes, even though the rates are set higher. During his campaign in 2008, John McCain pointed out that Ireland had a rather low corporate tax rate in comparison to the United States, and this was he was right in pointing this out, but Ireland's collected the taxes, and even so, the fact that Ireland had so low a rate was a contributing factor to the fact that Ireland is now among the worst shape of these countries. But there are different ways that we can tax, and we rely quite heavily on the income tax, and we have almost taken it as a matter of. And our understanding that things like sales taxes are regressive taxes, that because they're a certain amount flat rate on what you buy, they tend to penalize poor people more. So that we have an idea that we shouldn't do sales taxes. Well, interestingly enough, Europe does an awful lot of its taxing by what it calls the value-added tax, which is similar to a sales tax. You pay it on everything, and it goes at each level. So if you go to Europe, how many of you spent any time or much time in Europe?
Long enough to pay the VAT.
Oh, yeah, you just go across the border to Canada.
And you pay the VAT there, too. So usually what happens in Europe is you don't actually see that tax. You see what you do. You go into a restaurant in a typical European country, and you will notice that the prices in that restaurant are going to be 40 or 50% higher than they are here. You will see it. Though even to a country that has some of the better prices, like the Netherlands, where I get to a lot, and you will see that the prices are higher. But that is the pr-
price you pay. So what that price includes is the tip, which is already in there, 15%, which goes to the people. And it includes this VAT tax, which in some European countries, particularly Sweden, can be as high as 25%, this value-added tax. Now, this seems like it would be a very unfair thing because it really does penalize poor people because everybody is paying the same. But what the Europeans find is that, you know, of course, the people who are buying more and more goods end up paying more. And what that does is it ensures that everybody contributes something to the tax the tax system. That everybody, no matter in a way how poor, is putting something into the system. Now, how it becomes more fair is what that money gets used for. So, for instance, in the United Kingdom, you probably know that one of the major uses of VAT tax is to provide for the healthcare system. You know, it's paying so that in return, people get in those countries the free healthcare, the free education, various things. They get the kind of services which disproportionately benefit poor people because they are the least likely to be able to pay for them in the marketplace. So there are a lot of ways that we could be thinking about how we change taxes. They do more with excise taxes. And so if you buy a car, for instance, in many European countries, you'll pay some extra costs in taxes. You not only will pay a sales tax on the price of the car, but you will pay more based on the horsepower of the car. You pay an extra excise tax because the car is a powerful car, because that car is then at a cost. You're going to pay a lot more on gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Are there other ways that the tax is varied, the tax rate is varied in European countries according to whether the item seems to be a necessity, a luxury? I mean, is there anything like that? I mean, you have a car sort of prompted the
tax. And it depends on the country. Yeah, it depends on the country. Some food items are not taxed, some medicine items are not taxed, but restaurant food like we do it here is taxed and so forth. But there's no single answer to that question. Europeans are also doing more today with what we call green taxes. How many of you have heard of the concept of green taxes? What is a green tax?
That's where you tax your carbon consumption, basically. So that if you're using gasoline, for example, you pay a certain amount of tax related to that. It's mostly tied to energy consumption, at least in research.
Yeah, things like that. And it's a tax that taxes pollution, that taxes energy, that taxes those things that we want to prevent, makes those things more expensive. What it does is it leads a little bit toward what economists term full cost pricing. What we refer to as externalities, which are the costs that other people bear for the product that you buy, are figured more and more into the price of products there. So in some countries, these green taxes are quite high, and in return, income taxes are somewhat lower, and payroll taxes are somewhat lower. The amount of money that you, for instance, have to put in for your pension plan and so forth. Yes?
Some of these European countries have so-called sin tax for alcohol, pop, cigarettes that are higher than ours. I mean, the pop and the junk food that we have in this country, which contributes to obesity, seems to be sacred in terms of taxing it, and it would be one of the best ways to help limit some of that intake as well as pay for the health care.
Well, where are you from?
South Dakota.
We need you here in Washington State this year, because it will be on our, we just passed a law that, how many of you are from Washington State? You know that we just passed a law that increases the taxes on sweets and candy and pop and all those kind of things for precisely what you're talking about.
Movement.
And and we now have on the ballot an initiative that would repeal that new law. And there will be much money spent by the candy industry and the soda pop industry and the fast food folks and such in order to repeal that law. I don't know what the result will be. We really know. But yes, many of those things are taxed at higher levels. So certainly alcohol, we tax cigarettes pretty highly here in comparison to other countries. We don't tax alcohol quite as high as some of the other. How many of you have ever bought a beer in Sweden or Norway? you know it's a pricey thing. you know that you're going to pay about $7 for that beer.
Johnny Walker Black Label is a very nice gift in Japan.
Pardon?
Johnny Walker Black Label is a very desired gift in Japan.
Yeah,
if you take it to them as a present.
Probably pretty expensive too. Yeah, so they do have those kind of excise taxes, and there's a variety of things that we can do. And I think the whole concept is that we think about taxing more that which we don't want as much of, and taxing less those kinds of things which we'd like to see more of. So decreasing payroll taxes a little bit so that we will hire more people can be a good thing, but we have to offset that decrease with something else that will allow us to bring in some of the revenues. Now, when you hear, I'm going to use it to talk a little bit about language and the language, and I'm almost done, we're about done here now. We hear the words used a lot in this country, tax burden and tax relief. How many of you heard those terms? The tax burden and tax relief. Are those value neutral terms?
No.
What do you think of when you think of a term tax burden or tax relief? What do they already imply about the discussion?
Taxes are too high.
Yeah, it's just automatic. As soon as you've conceded this thing of the burden and relief and stuff, you've already conceded this sort of general argument that taxes are a bad thing. Now, the counter argument might be that not only are taxes the price we pay for civilization, and a lot of the things that have made us a very strong country, and maybe other Western countries strong because they've supported education, they've supported health, they've supported these kind of things. But also that sometimes it's cheaper to do things overall through the tax system than it is to simply try to do those things through the market. And healthcare is one of those things because it's very difficult to, it's all about risk pools. You know, healthcare is about how big the size of the people are, the number of people who are putting in to the risk pool. Because if it's too small, then an insurance company has to think, wow, if any significant portion of these people have a problem, a catastrophic illness, anything like that, I can be bankrupt because this pool is small. And so what I have to do is I have to keep the prices high enough and the overhead high enough to prevent that situation from occurring. And it does do that, but in good years, what it does for you, if that doesn't occur, is it means that you get very, very high profits. Now, if in fact you pool into two large risk pools, which like a single payer system or something, then the costs actually end up being less. And this is one of the reasons why many of these countries can provide healthcare to the entire population for 50%, 60% what we are spending on healthcare. And even some smaller countries are able to do this because they cover everybody. So I want to just close this now. And I want to encourage you to, if you have a chance to come hear Dave tomorrow, talk about the sustainability side, the longest run. But any final questions before we're over? And I hope that, if nothing else, this has gotten you to think a little bit about what inequality really means.
Now, do you have some sort of bibliography on a website? You cited a number of books.
Yeah, what I need to do, I think, is
go in there and write down books and websites and stuff and pass out a sheet for everybody on this. And it's my dereliction of duty.
Well, I was thinking there might be a website we could go to, but that's...
Well, I said, you know, some of the inequality, the best one is equalitytrust.uk. And it's a British website, but it has all the information on U.S. states as well, so you can get that. A good one, if you're interested in all the data about children and how children are affected in terms of health and everything else in different states of the United States, is a site called...
Children's Defense Fund.
What's that?
Children's.
It's not the Children's Defense Fund, but it's actually similar to that. It's called I'll find it out.
Well, Dave, where are you when we need you?
Oh yeah, I got it. I get that one, I'm not sure, but you know, I was just gonna add a couple things to think about. In the 1930s, it was very interesting. Of course, our country had no minimum wage, and a couple things that we did was we put a limit on work hours, so we established a 40-hour work week, which was the first nation to do that, and a model for the rest of the developed nations, and that added more employment for people. So instead of working 10, 12 hours a day, and Saturdays as well, America cut back and worked 7 days a week and 8 hours, or 5 days a week and 8 hours a day, and established a minimum wage. And so there were a set of policies put in place to actually change inequality, which also fit with giving people a little more free time and a few other things. And so now we're again at a place where our society is becoming greater and greater inequality. And so what are some things that we might start doing about that, if we perceive that as a society as sort of a problem? And one of the things, you know, one of my experiences, we're funded by, our little nonprofit is funded by the Russell Family Foundation. It was very nice to meet George Russell, who's a billionaire. One of his biggest points is this wealth distribution issue. And even he says, you know, he has too much money, interestingly, and this is what has been dealt to him, more or less. He was a very skilled businessman. But he goes to Turkey and other countries and in the U.S. to say, you know, this is a very severe problem because opportunity is connected to equity and fairness. And I think around the world, this is not just an issue for the United States, but probably the biggest worry in China is the fact that they're churning out a greater and greater wealth distribution differential, which is really unstable. People are making a dollar or less, over 200 million people make less than a dollar a day, and then about 200 more million people make about a dollar a day, and then you've got, you know, this expansion.
Billionaires, yeah.
And billionaires. And this is a real an issue which that leadership finds to be very unnerving, and a lot of countries, though, we've experienced these sort of things, and also the way countries grow. So sometimes Brazil had a huge period of growth, and during that period of growth, 60% of the population's incomes went down in the 70s, and was really captured by a very tiny number. And it caused a lot of political instability. And so now in Brazil, they have a different set of policies. So these things are really important. And even Japan's equity, why is Japan such an equal nation? Because it wasn't in 1940. It was really a feudal society. And in fact, MacArthur, the first thing he did was a massive wealth redistribution and land redistribution, so that almost every Japanese farmer had a little plot of land and farming, and that gave them a piece of capital and such. Now, we're not proposing that kind of radical proposal yet in the U.S., but the thing is that societies have done different things. In Singapore, there was almost free housing provided just to give everybody a stock of value that they could borrow against for a business and such. So you need to think about, there's so many different options out there. It's kind of, but it's something that I think it's time our society had a bit of discussion about.
And we did promote those things, not only in Japan, but also in Germany. This is the interesting thing. How many of you have ever heard of what's called co-determination? This is actually the policy in German industry, and what it means is that half of Germany's big companies' boards of directors have to be elected by the workers. And this is why they
They have not allowed their companies to simply outsource jobs all over the place, and Germany still has a very big industrial sector and a very good trade balance. This particular law was forced on Germany in 1945 by the United States as a way of punishing the German industrialists for the support of them. But we would not do it here. So I've talked to people in the UK, for example, who will say, well, actually, you know, in all truth, the German workers won the Second World War. They got the best deal out of it because we came in and we punished the other guys. The website for all the data on kids, and this has to do with everything from child abuse to all the differences in states, is everychildmatters.org. And then you can go everychildmatters/homelandinsecurity/index.html. But if you just go to everychildmatters, this will come up. And it's a very well illustrated graph. Both of these things have terrific graphics that lay out what the extent of all this is. So thank you very much.